When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul, and hello to everyone at home.
Yeah, well, after a nice quiet August, we've certainly come back to the stock market school with a bit of a bang this week because we've had a deluge of corporate results. We certainly have kept your team very busy, to say the least, working that midnight oil. But we've always run through specific stocks at all. Have you been buying or selling anything over the past 7 days?
I always forget. Nothing significant. Okay. No. Oh, okay, yeah. I topped up my wall paint position, but I know we're going to come on to that.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's top of the
down,
tree.
It's top of the tree. Yeah. I averaged down after the profit warning and having considered all the numbers and whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I added to my eagle eye actually this week because we've got some results.
You?
Yeah. We've got some results coming out this week. So I've now got a total full position, which is quite nice. But
this week or next week? I think it's next week, isn't it? Eagle eye?
Yeah. It is. Yeah. You and I think, are speaking to the management team.
We're booked in to see. Yeah. We're having one of our joint calls, aren't we, to speak to management? So it should be good.
Hot off the press. Brilliant. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's start with some of the hottest questions coming through from the audience. First one, top of the tree, has got to be Warpaint Cosmetics because it's a real firm favorite of many private investors. Challenger Cosmetics brand being expanding abroad from the UK into Europe and out into the States, but had a bit of a shocking profit warning this week. What was your overall take on it?
Well, it was very disappointing. I mean, they told us, we can't gloss over this. I wouldn't want to gloss over it. We just give our views warts and all. And here we are. I've just found my notes on it that I published yesterday afternoon. So, yeah, quite a nasty profit warning, which there's been a lot of emotion flying around on the bulletin boards about this. And I think we have to try and take the emotion out of it and just reappraise the numbers on the facts, figures and forecasts that we've now got. But you see, they were saying as recently as 17th of June, they confirmed they were in line for the full year expectation, full year, forecast with an H2 weighting, but that's normal seasonality for them. So they dropped a bombshell yesterday and the broker forecasts for the full year have been dropped about 30%, which is not a good look when you're well over halfway through the year. They've really dropped a clanger. There's no getting away from it. I could go into more detail, but do you want me to?
What's the reason for the sales slowdown? I mean, that's the main nuts of it. I mean, in terms of, is it temporary? Is it competitive? Is it they're not getting shelf space, distribution?
Well, it's a variety of things. I mean, they don't really go into that level of granularity, but I mean, the sector has been soft, hasn't it? We've had other makeup companies, saying it's tough. Now, in my view, people don't buy less makeup. They're just buying it from someone else, aren't they? So I think the competition question is the key one. And obviously the word on everyone's lips is the question rather is this the Chinese direct to consumer competition eating at least a bit of their lunch, and it could well be. So we don't really know. The other thing is Warpaint acquired Brand Architects in February, so that should have boosted the numbers. So I worked out, so they said, oh, revenue is up 8% in H1, but I stripped out Brand Architects, and like-for-like revenue was 6% down. So, I mean, not a disaster, let's keep it in perspective, but it certainly, I think it undermines now the credibility of management assurances. I think now in the Outlook comments, I'm going to be much more sceptical about if they say they're tracking in line with expectations, having told us that up until June and now missed. So there is an issue of trust there for sure. Reasons, now it's a mixed bag actually, Paul, because the gross margin has been rising steadily year on year, and it rose from 42.5% to 45%. So that is very good. Various factors on the sales miss, and the outlook wasn't good either. They're saying there was a big Forex loss, which hit the statutory numbers, but not the adjusted numbers. Trying to think what the reasons were. Can you remember? Yeah. I've got a bit blank. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would say, I think you're absolutely spot on first and foremost with the competition angle, because if you look at the quarterly results from a big challenger brand out in the States, Elf Beauty, their biggest overseas market is the UK. And they reported that they had trebled the growth rate in the UK. So they were winning market share, and they'd got new distribution in Superdrug, Boots, all that kind of stuff, the classic sort of, extra higher competition, but this time from a US brand who's probably bringing product in from China direct and servicing the UK retailers. And what it also said, Elf Beauty, was that the US market had actually toughened up because of the tariffs, because the prices had gone up. And I think, and this is obviously only 10%, but they haven't got the growth in the US. So I think you're exactly right. It's competition related, and there's a bit of tariff out in the States. And what that means when you come to looking at it going forward is it going to continue growing? And I think that there's a question actually just on the board from Andrew Kay. He's basically asking whether it's a value trap or a value play. Now, having just bought some shares, Paul, as you rightly you said, you just bought some. Is what how are you viewing it? Value trap or value play?
I think value play, because if you go through the narrative, the commentary from the company, there's actually quite a lot of positive stuff. They said they put their prices up, which will benefit H2 margins further. And if the company was really under some kind of structural decline, they'd be having to discount. I mean, look at Revolution Beauty. They've had terrible problems over the last few years with all this stock that they couldn't sell, and they had to sort of clear it at less than cost. Well, Warpaint is delivering higher gross margins and they're raising prices. So that is not the sign of a business that's got serious competition problems, actually. And they've only got a very small market share. And they said here there was a specific customer that's gone bust that's knocked 0.8 million off the profitability. So that's a one-off factor. The Forex hopefully is a one-off factor, and it could even be swings and roundabouts. So I'm not bothered about that. So the way I looked at this, it seems to me, as the company used the phrase, these are short-term headwinds, but they're pretty negative about the consumer outlook. They said, consumer and customer confidence is subdued and likely to remain so for a time. So I'm not looking for a kind of instant rebound on this, but I'm working out the valuation on 11 times these revised slashed earnings with a very strong balance sheet and lots of growth potential. Remember, if you look at it glass half full, they do mention in detail some quite large additional store rollouts with existing customers who are rolling the product out to more, hundreds of more stores in H2. Now that is bullish. And you've got entrepreneurial owner managers here who own 38% of the business. You've got a fabulous track record. So to me, putting aside the anger and the upset that a lot of the subscribers of my Substack expressed yesterday, I think maybe they're letting their emotions...
I'm not surprised. Run away.
No, I'm not surprised, but I think, I've had hundreds of profit warnings over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm used to them. And you just take a step back and you say, okay, get the anger out of your system in about 5 minutes, and then say, right, let's look at the revised forecast. Yeah. Don't buy immediately. Never buy immediately. Get your revised numbers, crunch the numbers and say, if I ignore the fact that you hold them already and say, if I didn't hold them, would I buy them now? And I would say kind of around £2, I think it'd be a no-brainer. But yeah. I bought some more yesterday at £2.26, I think it was, and I'm happy with that. I think, you know, I look medium term. I'm not a short-term trader. I have no idea what it'll do. And obviously my buy at £2.86 is looking a bit daft. But you see, I did it was very small. I sized it small because I knew it was, and the chart you see was telling us there was going to be a profit warning. Yeah. The chart on Zofoams looked exactly the same and they smashed it out of the park with a head. Yeah, so you can't read anything from the charts. Every situation is unique. So there are always three profit warnings in a row. No, there aren't. Sometimes there are, sometimes there aren't. I think you just look at each situation individually. And the tariffs, interestingly enough, Wallpaint said it might move some production to Britain.
Yeah, okay, right.
Export into the US. I thought that was interesting.
So you believe it's a value play because of the earnings is okay for this year. I think they want about 20p, don't they, of earnings?
They've just done 8.5 in H1. So, and I checked the seasonality over the last 5 years, and it is normally quite a lot stronger at H2. It's inconsistent because of the COVID years were mucked about with, weren't they? But, and they do, I think, give solid, if companies get say an H2 weighting, I want evidence. I want them to say, well, why are you expecting an H2 weighting? Because all too often it's just, we're hoping, you know, to catch up. Whereas in this case, they did itemize the various things, in particular the additional rollouts with existing customers, that I think do give some substance to that. So for the moment, I'm, you know, a PE of 11 with a lovely bulletproof balance sheet. I'm prepared to give them the benefit of that. I think another warning is possible, but I wouldn't say a big warning is likely. Yeah, okay. I think also there was some customer destocking as well, wasn't there? They're saying the retailers maybe are putting in smaller orders for Christmas. They didn't specifically say that, but I think that's possibly it could be an issue, couldn't it? So your overall view then sounds reasonably bullish. Are you half full or half empty?
I think the competition is getting much tougher, and isn't just from the Chinese, it's basically from the US brand. I mean, I would say have a look at the earnings, you know, statement from Elf Beauty in the States, and they specifically singled out the UK that they were taking market share because they'd grown three times the rate of the sector, which says to me they've got more shelf space. And if you get more shelf space, the shops aren't growing, somebody's losing it.
Very good points, Paul. But as I say, the margins appreciation in Wallpaint tells me they're not, you know, they're not having to discount. So I think, not sure how those play out. But at the current valuation, and as I say, absolutely bulletproof balance sheet, loads of surplus working capital there. So they're under absolutely zero financial pressure. So you've got no placing or insolvency risk at all. So I think on balance, I'm only actually in a relatively small position even now. You know, I think position sizing is so important. If in doubt, keep them small. That's what I do. I don't want to run straight into a profit. I normally buy after trading updates. This was quite unusual for me to buy beforehand, but I kept it very small, pretty much unscathed in terms of my overall portfolio. And, you know, if it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, I'll just buy more. So,
Okay, let's move different sectors. Let's go to fooding, flavors and fragrances. We've got a cheeky bid for Treat this week at £2.60 from a private equity-backed trade buyer, Natara. And we've got Drew, Priv Investor and Richard Lebington all asking about, what's your thoughts on the deal? Because it looks a bit on the low side.
That's what I think too. But let me get you start on this one, Paul, because you hold this one personally, and I think you know more about it than me. So
I bought before two profit warnings, so I'm still well underwater. However, I would say at the moment, having you and I both spoke to the CEO, Dave Shannon, about a month ago, the business seems to have bottomed. And the big issue is to sort the culture out of the company to get that top line. And he was pretty much certain, yes, it was going to be a transitionary year this year, but next year should start seeing some benefits of that and some new products. And they've got those new factories they've built. So if you put all that together, they've basically got a net tangible asset of good quality assets. These are newly built factories of about £2.30. The bid is at £2.60 plus. They've got trough earnings. I mean, you know, you look at actually their EBITDA, and we're currently, well, their EBIT is about 8%. And Dave said to us he's looking to get that to 15. So they're basically, the bid has done a standard bid of about 10 times EBITDA, which is on the cheap side for these type of businesses, on trough earnings. Hence, you get the £2.60. Why has the board agreed it? Now, the only reason I think the board has agreed it, it wants to get the ball rolling, because this has been on the sort of like the shelf as a potential acquisition consolidation play for the industry for years. So I think they've basically said, right, okay, let's put a sort of line in the sand and then see where we get to. So there's no way I am selling at £2.60 at the moment. My position won't make a difference in terms of the voting rights. It will go to they haven't got that many big shareholders. I know the biggest one is Columbia Threadneedle, which is James Thorne, and he will be, I haven't spoken to him, but I'm sure he'll be adamantly against it. And then you've just had this other guy, you've had a hedge fund come in who's also, you know, seems to be against it as well, because he's bought the position against. So I think Natara, if worst of case, have got to increase their offer to get it over the line. I think they know that anyway. And there's a good chance that somebody else comes on board. So that's my take on it. But what's yours?
Well, I've been discussing it with the readers. I mean, I think it's an insultingly low offer, as you say. Yeah. Some shareholders have suffered the pain all the way down from about 12 or 13 pounds peak. And the reason you stick with companies when they have that sort of fall is because you believe in the company and its ability to recover. So to then have an opportunistic bid come in at an insultingly low price, really, to try to whip the upside recovery away from you, I think is dreadful. And I cannot understand why, because this is not just a bid approach, you know, mooted bid. This is a proper formal bid. So Matt, I can't understand. I mean, there are two explanations, I think, for why management have agreed it. And this is speculation, obviously. I haven't spoken to them since, you know, the bid approach. It's that they're doing it for personal reasons. I mean, some of my readers flagged this. You know, private equity deals offer management often substantial personal upside if they deliver on stretch targets. And at the moment, management has negligible shareholding. So it could be self-interest. And that's fine. You know, you shareholders own the business and you can say no to the deal. So the only other reason I can think of is that maybe they've consulted the larger institutional holders, because it's inconceivable they wouldn't have consulted them. And maybe enough of them want a liquidity event and just want out. So, I mean, those are the only things I can think of, but it's for me, it definitely gets a thumbs down. I think it's a terrible deal.
Yeah, I don't think they've consulted the shareholders, because there's nobody more than about six, wasn't previously more than 6% on the shareholder register.
Well, that's bizarre, because I mean, you don't agree a bid without. I mean, my understanding is management teams, you know, will always take their big holders inside and sound them out, because they'd have to resign, I think, if the bid is rejected by shareholders.
No, they don't. They don't. Unless you've got a sizable shareholder, a lot of them don't, because effectively the problem is then you risk actually having a leak. It goes outside. And we've got to remember, this one's been going on since May. They had a non-disclosure. I think it's as simple as AIM's not a great, you know, market to operate on, because it's in the public eye. It needs to be turned around. It's a pain in the proverbial for a lot of managements who don't like being on AIM. And I think they've just basically put, you know, somebody's come in and put an offer and they've said, right, okay, let's see what the shareholders do. I've seen it in the past where you don't have these dominant shareholders who've, and then, and I'm with you. regardless of what the reason is, I'm pretty damn sure most shareholders are going to vote against this at
£2.60. Yes, I agree. I think it'd be crazy to vote for it. Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure Natara know that, and so it all comes down to what the clearing price is, and I would say anything less than £3 is really cheap. But we'll wait and see. But I think at £2.60, it isn't happening.
No, I totally agree. It's ridiculous. You could be right. I mean, we had you do sometimes get bid situations. I mean, obviously, we both over the years seen probably hundreds of bids, haven't we? And yeah. Lavendon springs to mind, where a low initial bid came in. Then I think at least one other, maybe two other parties got involved, and it was back and forward. Before you knew it, the end outcome was fantastic. It was way above the original approach. So I hope for all of you Treat shareholders that this turns out like that. If I held personally, I definitely wouldn't be selling in the market. I'd be because I'd be happy if the bid fell through, because I think it would only drop maybe 20p or something. But you'd then get the long-term upside. So yeah, I would, if it was me, I would give this a definite no vote for £2.60.
I'll tell you, it'd be brilliant, wouldn't it, if somebody came in with a higher bid on the 31st of October in about a month and a half's time. Oh, Halloween, trick and treat. It'll be brilliant.
Yes. Well, actually, it was Lawrence Hulse who came up with the... He put a pun out about saying, is this a trick or treat? I thought that was very good. So I borrowed that from my daily report.
Okay, let's move to healthcare. Both you and I spoke to the management team at Shield Therapeutics yesterday to the CEO and the CFO, we thought we'd just relay back the sort of the their comments and their insights, which were excellent. But this is obviously a share that you own, Paul, and you must be pretty happy because it's gone from 2.5p to nearly 8.5p.
I didn't initially grasp the stellar growth that they've reported when it started that big move. But one of the readers said to me, and I have a look at this more carefully, Paul, because I just thought, oh, cash burner, you know, terrible track record, stretched balance sheet, so not for me. But then I watched the webinar with management and thought, actually, this is really interesting. Absolutely stunning growth coming through. It is risky, though. I do want to emphasize this is not for widows and orphans, but it's this. Do you want to talk us through your perspectives, Paul, and I'll collect my thoughts from
I mean, just a reminder for everybody, Shield Therapeutics does a well-tolerated iron tablet that helps people with iron deficiency and anemia to have a better quality of life. If you go for traditional iron tablets, they're heavy in salt, things like ferrous sulfate, ferrous glutenate, and they give you things unfortunately like constipation or the other way could actually give you the a bit of diarrhea. So but it's not awful situation. But anyway, what it means is that their particular tablet is prescribed for those people with anemia or iron deficiency who can't tolerate the traditional salts, and that's out in the States, etc. And those can be for things, you know, you might need it for cancer or for IBD and this sort of stuff. Anyway, the CEO and the CFO were giving us a rundown of how the business is doing, and it appears their quarterly sales growth quarter on quarter is roughly nearly 20%. Hence, they get to their last results, which was 80% like year on year growth, and importantly, that is sustainable. They have a revenue share agreement with their distributor, Viatis, I think it's called, out in the States, of about 55-45. And they're hoping to get to break-even EBITDA of roughly about $80 million. And I think cash break-even on an operating basis is roughly around about $65 million. But that's before they have to pay interest, and it's just normal OCF break-even. They have a bit of debt. But basically in the States, they are just selling this hand over fist, which is manufactured out in France and then imported into the States. There is a bit of a tariff risk, but not much on a high value. So I was pretty impressed by just how much this is growing, and they've got a patent over it for 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, some key points I've underlined from my notes, they said basically there's negligible competition And as you say, it's patent protected for another 10 years. Now, a number that that really surprised me, they reckon it's basically all about the USA market. They are looking at other international markets, but forget those. For valuing the shares, we need to just focus on the USA. They're saying peak revenue, their forecast, in, which I presume is out there in market forecast, is $450 million a year. Well, I mean, that would produce a staggering amount of profits and cash flow, and you could probably put a zero on the end of the market cap if it gets to that sort of level. You know, so it's one of these things. It's a moonshot, but the growth is actually happening. It's not blue sky. They said the awareness of the product is the big challenge. If they can crack that, and they've got a team of 40 sales marketing people, and the US distributor also employs 40 people, and they say they can measure very precisely where their spend is effective, because they see an immediate payback from that particular customer. So they've got good targeted marketing spend. And they said they need to constantly remind the doctors or the GPs or whatever the equivalent is in America that this product is there and that it's very highly effective. And they said they're basically only scratching the surface of the market. And it's the number one branded, prescribed, tolerated iron deficiency product in the US. Huge number of people anemic, obviously. I think it looks very interesting. Balance sheet, and now they've got this highly supportive, I think, controlling 50% odd shareholder, haven't they, who extended some loans to them, and they basically said that's really taken the pressure off them. They're very open and honest, saying they've had their backs against the wall on cash flow for years, and now they're in a position where it's coming right, and that the shareholder support with no dilution obviously was key to that. So they've got this really highly committed major shareholder, which should mean that we're not taken out on the cheap, assuming it does work. But I think that's the most likely outcome, isn't it, on this? You know, if the sales growth continues at this trajectory, you could have a very valuable business in 2 or 3 years' time that then probably gets bid for by a larger pharmaceutical group. I mean, is that your view as well?
Yeah, I would agree. I think the one thing is, you know, in the efficacy, because when we spoke to Anders, the CEO, he said basically the argument or the reason people are prescribed it is not for efficacy, because it's a similar efficacy in terms of getting iron into an individual as a normal iron sulfate, ferrous sulfate. It's all to do with toleration. It's the side effects which is the hinge on it. And therefore, it comes down to an economic and a healthcare decision by the authorities and the doctors about how much extra you pay for the better side, the least damaging. You know, they haven't got side effects, but as in, like, you know, this is for side effects. And just give you an indication on cost, it's about the tablet is about $230 per month for the treatment. Mm. Patients are on it for about 3 to 4 months. And a comparison to a ferrous sulfate monthly is about £5. So there's a significant, and the economics effectively stop the NHS from prescribing it. And that's why it's not adopted in the UK and not adopted in Europe. And the big market is the States, where it's all insurance backed, and therefore the individual can get that on Medicaid or can get it on for insurance. And then the other markets it potentially looks as though it's trying to get to is Japan, where there's a similar dynamic, and then China they're hoping to get to as well. So it comes down to is the benefit of the lower side effects worth justified for the financials? And in the States, they've reached the view that it is, which is the biggest and most, you know, sort of like largest opportunity. Whereas in the UK, being a bit more cost conscious, they've decided it isn't.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's a purely an open-ended growth thing. We'll just have to sit and wait and watch and hope that the growth is as stellar as management say it could be. So they seem pretty grounded to me. I don't know. Again, I like having these Zooms that you and I do together. Yeah. So you can do most of the talking and I can just sit and absorb it all. And then it works very well. And I like to just pick up on the, I don't know, that just the body language and the way they answer questions. Are we getting a clear, crisp answer, or are we getting a degree of waffle? And for me, these guys seem pretty, I thought positive. I didn't really have any, you know, no alarm bells rang. Let's put it like that. I thought, I think they're straightforward. We're getting direct answers to our questions. So that I think is good.
Yeah, I think they were first class, actually. I thought they were really good. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, good. Okay, let's just change sectors again. We've got Rebecca. She's asking about Choo-Choo train line. And obviously the UK ticket operator, but they do mainly, obviously, for Europe as well. And it's long distance. They came out results. I think today their number...
Today, wasn't it? Yeah.
Their shares are up 10%, actually, at the bell. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, I can't find my page on this, but my colleague John wrote about this today, and we like it. We think it, obviously, there are competitive issues, I believe, and I wish I could remember the name of my reader that flagged this up, but a few months ago, they indicated that apparently Uber is trying to muscle into this sector in the UK and offering quite generous reward type scheme and discounts if you book your train tickets through Trainline. So I think that is a worry. But having said that, that does seem to be, here we are, I found it, does seem to be reflected in quite a modest valuation. It's only on about 13 or 14 times forward earnings, Trainline is, which is not much for a high margin repeating revenues tech company, is it really? And today's update, H1 trading update to June, to August. This was the trading update, not the actual figures. Robust H1 revenue growth. There was some sign of margin squeeze, I think, because the net ticket sales were up 8%, but the group revenue was up 2%. So a little bit of margin pressure there, it looks like. And a big buyback. We think 150 million new buyback was announced. And we think it's probably that's got the market excited as well. So it read pretty well. This was it. This is the key thing. Sorry, I forgot. EBITDA growth, it's saying, will be at the top end of previous guidance, between 6% and 9% for the full year. So it's looking pretty healthy, we think, at Trainline, and the valuation's reasonable. So yeah, quite good. I have held them briefly before, but I think probably the competitive pressure puts me off going back into this one personally. But does it float your boat, Paul?
The two sort of like headwinds that I haven't yet really hit into the P&L. First one is basically the percentage of commissions is going down that they're allowed to charge their customers. And that's mandated by the regulator and by the government. And I think I think it went down from 5% to 4.5%, which is one of the reasons why their sales growth wasn't as fast as their total sales.
Yes.
So you've got that sort of like hitting it a bit. But the big issue
is there going to be any further reduction in those percentages?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
The bigger issue is longer term, and it's twofold. First of all, is the government is going to do its own Great British Railways website?
Yeah,
compete directly. That could take years to do. So let's not bank on that. But if it is, then they're going to compete against another player who's going to have zero, you know, commissions in there, so that's going to be a bit tougher. And then the other one is the train operators, the franchises, are rolling out this tap and go software. And if you do tap and go, then you don't really need ticketing long term, because essentially you've got that all the way through. So I would say in the UK market, there's going to be some headwinds. However, I think Trainline would equally argue that they're attacking more so the corporate travel world, whereby they go to businesses and say, we'll sort out all your ticketing, you know, to go from, I don't know, London to Paris or London to Brussels. And it just does it all in one go. So I think the opportunity for them is less consumer. It's more corporate and more into Europe. But there's definitely their biggest market is the UK. And this headwinds coming down the track in the next 2 or 3 years.
I think that's probably the reason I don't think I'm going to personally buy into Trainline. It just kind of feels like it might be a sort of old hat, unnecessary intermediary. Do you know what I mean? Longer term. So not for me, but we were quite impressed with today's update, would be my summary.
Okay, good. Let's move to oil and gas. We've got Frank. He's asking about Gulf Marine Services, which I know you own. And there's been some quite big headlines over the last week because of the big oil majors, the likes of BP, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, have been, unfortunately, making a lot of people redundant as the oil prices come down and actually pulling the horns back on their production because OPEC is actually now opening the spigot to take more market share. So it's looking a weak market for the oil price. But what how's that impacting at all, if at all, you know, the effectively the platform operator in the Middle East, Gulf Marine Services?
Well, I have to say, I only skim read the announcement and it sounded fine. And the broker actually slightly edged up the EBITDA range, which is the normal figures they quote. But then the EPS dropped by about a third. And we thought, what the hell's going on? So anyway, one of my team did a write-up on it, an abbreviated one. And basically, there seems to be almost some sort of forecasting error, I would suggest, where they've massively increased the depreciation charges, as you have. And we're scratching our heads a bit on this, but I haven't really looked into it in great detail yet. I'm not doing anything. I'm holding my position because the numbers that did impress me with this update was the deleveraging. And that's what the whole, that's why I'm in the shares, because net debt was completely out of hand 3 or 4 years ago. And they've been paying it down incredibly fast. And it's now, mostly eradicated the debt they had. So this thing has generated colossal amounts of cash. It's cleared down most of its bank debt, which is precisely what they said they'd do. So that's the story I'm holding the shares for. And this thing that just seems an inexhaustible supply of sellers in the market of GMS. But if you, as you say, you've zoomed out to the long term there, it's done really, really well. But it's kind of oscillating sideways at the moment. And I don't know what the catalyst for that to change would be, but it's so cheap on the valuation metrics I've got that I'm just going to hold forever, really.
Yeah. Well, I would say this is a cyclical industry. Okay.
It is.
It's a cyclical. It's a bit high beta play on a cyclical industry because it's big pieces of kit that they rent out at very high day rates. And what this says to me, it reading between the lines, particularly from the big majors, is that the day rates are coming down. The order book is still fine because you've basically banked that and you've contracted it over the last 12 months. But I think that the margin, the day rates are coming down because if the big majors are not producing as much and it's mainly done by the national oil companies out in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, then unfortunately, I think they're basically dominating the pricing. I could be wrong, but that's what it says to me anyway.
I'm sure you're right, because I remember seeing some slides from Gulf Marine Services of the long-term historical patterns. And it is very cyclical. The problem they got into was they overinvested and bought far too many vessels on debt. Exactly the wrong point in the last cycle. That was the old management. I think the new management are much, much more cautious. So I don't think they'll make the same mistake again. And if we are going into, which it sounds like plausibly we could be, a downturn in the sector, they're going into it having paid off the bulk of their debt. So as long as they don't, there are lots of new ships on order but from competitors, which they flagged before. Yeah. So oversupply, it could go from one of those situations where, cash machine for a few years and then oversupply, which is very typical of the shipping sector generally, isn't it? You get precisely the same issue with too many container ships being built in the boom times and blah, blah, blah. But I just think overall, because you're also trading way below book value at GMS. The book values are understated. And so you've got double backing. You've got the asset backing and an incredibly low EBITDA multiple. So I'm sticking with it. And they can repurpose these ships for offshore maintenance of wind farms. Yeah. That's the other thing. They've got one in the North Sea doing that, I believe. So you have kind of got, I remember we had a Zoom with management some time ago, and they said it doesn't cost much to convert them to operate as wind farm support vessels. You basically just add a sort of sling on the side, a big, big metal contraption that can hold the fins of the wind. You know, he said the customer would pay for the customization anyway. So that is a bit of a wild card here that could be more positive. So yeah, it's not a big position of mine, but I'm happy to just, I'm just holding it medium term really, and I'll stay in it and see what happens.
I think the other mistake that the previous management team did when they went into a downturn was they weren't competitive on day rates. And I'm absolutely...
That's right, yes.
I'm absolutely convinced these two guys are very commercial and are not going to be beaten on price. They're going to make sure they utilization.
Yep. You're right.
Yeah.
I remember having exactly that conversation with the current CEO last year, I think. And he said, what they did was they said to the oil majors, no, this is the contract price. That's what you're paying. And basically the customers just cancelled the orders.
Yes.
And they had a whole bunch of ships sitting there doing nothing. This guy says, no, look, you know, if we get into that situation, we go to them and we say, look, we'll share your pain. Yeah. Let's keep the ships busy. So yeah, they seem much more commercial.
Good. Okay, we've got a question from Paul the Parrot. He's basically asking about industrial pneumatics and hydraulics provider distributor Flowtech Fluid Power. Yeah. He says he's looking interesting, actually. Just what's your latest view? It's been a long time coming, this sort of turnaround of this business.
It has. No, we feel the same. My colleague Dave took the lead on this one. For some reason, it's not coming up on my search, but I'll try and remember what he said. He basically said, here we are, Tuesday, 9th of September. Dave is a shrewd investor, one of my team, and he basically said he thinks there are green shoots here. It's starting to look like the turnaround story could actually have legs, we think. The debt was a bit of a problem in the past. It doesn't seem to be too bad. Here we are, found my notes on it. So, yeah, we've moved up a notch from amber to amber green, which is equivalent to 3-star to 4-star with our personal view on it. Slow turnaround. I won't go into all the numbers, but basically, we do think there's just slight emerging evidence that this could be starting to work. So is that your and you've got the Harvard boys in here with about 27% of the company, and they do tend to get most things right, I have to say.
Now, I mean, I would add to it, what I quite like about this turnaround is they seem to be now doing more services rather than just doing the parts, because they've got two bridge contracts. They had one announced out in Ireland, whereby over a 10-year contract, they'll be doing all of the hydraulics and pneumatics. And I think, you know, all the servicing for it for a 10-year contract. So that's locking them in into this, you know, sort of like recurring revenue stream and visibility. And if you do that, then eventually you will get scalable, you know, a scalable business and stronger firm, you know, gross margins and a higher valuation. So I think that what they're doing is exactly right. But there is still a lot of competition, no doubt about it. And so I would definitely say that it's not out the woods yet, but it is making good, you know, sort of good progress. Just in terms, I've got a question from Phil, actually, just on bowl charts, basically. This is something that Richard Crowe, you know, a Cockney Rebel.
Yes.
Loves. And we're getting a bit of a bowl, and we've basically had some director buy. How much significance do you take from bowls? Phil would like to know about.
Well, it's not my area of expertise, charting at all, but I think, you know, I would just take a really simplistic look at that chart that you've put up there. And you can, I like charts. So I suppose, I do like bowls. I like to see a situation where it's bottoming out. It's kind of gone sideways, or, you know, not making new lows over a kind of 6-month odd period. So, which I think is pretty much what Richard talks about when he talks about bowls, doesn't he? So I would definitely pay some attention to something that's bottomed out nicely over a decent length of time. And I think Mark Minervini, who is a very popular trader and writer, I think he calls that sort of bottoming thing. Does he call it phase one or something like that? And I think, you know, it's the measure of sentiment, isn't it? The chart. It's telling you what the balance of buying and selling is. So you'd be crazy to ignore it. I think it's part of our toolkit, definitely. So the only thing I would say with Flowtech Fluid Power as well is that I was really surprised when those bridge contracts came out, because I thought it was a distributor of, you know, with tens of thousands of SKUs of sort of hydraulic hoses and things for tractors and all that sort of thing. So I was really surprised when they were winning these large services contracts. And that does introduce an element of execution risk, doesn't it? If they bungle one of those big contracts and have completely mispriced it, that's a lot more serious than if they just accidentally, you know, give somebody too much discount on some widgets. So what are your thoughts on that, Paul? Is that
I think it's exactly the thing they need to go into. You've combined OEM sales, product sales, with aftermarket sales. And so you basically, you install it and then you monitor it. I think it's exactly the right thing to do. It gives them visibility. It gives them control of what products they put into it. They're not beholden to their customers and pricing. I think it makes perfect sense to me. I think it's exactly the right strategy. And I would add, with the bowls, what I found from my experience is that actually what happens with a lot of companies is that you've got, obviously, they supply customers and they're supplied by suppliers. And these people know which companies are improving because they speak to these businesses all the time. And even employees, and therefore it tends to be a reflection of what people in the know, not necessarily in the company, but in customers and suppliers or even competitors. And therefore you then start seeing in a liquid stock marginal buying. So I think that's why, you know, Richard's policy of going for bowls actually overall, I mean, nothing's certain, but overall tends to work.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose offsetting that, I'm still seeing very clear evidence of institutional redemptions and semi-forced selling, because you've only got to look at the sheer quantity of share buybacks, and the many dozens of companies are doing daily share buybacks. Where the hell is all this stock coming from? Yeah. You know, you've definitely still got a big indigestion in this, which has now been a four-year bear market in UK small caps, hasn't it? And it doesn't feel like we're out of the woods in terms of that indigestion, I feel. So, but yeah, interesting debate for sure.
No, you're exactly right. There was actually some figures out on the last month from Calistone this week, and it showed that you had another month of outflows from, you know, active fund managers, which is, you know,
Yeah,
it's forcing us. Okay, well, we're just going to move sector to the tech sector. We've got Value Hound. He's asking about PCI Pal, which does software that helps protect the security of people when they want to pay for something using a credit card and they call a call center. It's to make sure that the call center operator can't see the credit card details and whether that's punched in by the guy or spoken in, whatever. But they do the software behind it. They came out with some pretty good results actually this week.
Yeah, I've been a bit skeptical on that. I've been a long-term bull on PCI Pal for years and years. I always thought it would work because they were delivering, you know, strong organic growth over many years. But I did express some frustration earlier this year about the fact that every time they whenever you think they're approaching profitability, management suddenly find a new market to go into, have to employ more, decide they're going to employ more. You know, the overheads just constantly rise and it never gets into profit. Well, anyway, I've changed my tune on it a bit because we actually upped it a notch from amber to amber green because we just change our mind when the facts change, you know, and these figures were good. We thought it moved into modest profitability, very good revenue growth. I think the revenue growth is accelerating here, isn't it? So the cash position's okay. That legal issue, they got into quite a messy legal fight with a competitor that they won, basically. They did a smallish placing, I think, not that long ago. Yeah, here we are. Revenue growth of 25%. This is for the 12 months to June. That's very good. And annualized recurring revenue also rose by 25%. It's nearly all recurring revenues, which we like. So current trading in line. And the only drawback on it is that the Cavendish forecasts show it going back into a loss in the current year, which is really frustrating. So I think they're doing the same thing, you know, saying, oh, we need to spend more on product development and on marketing, which is probably the right decision for the long-term health of the business. But it's frustrating from a small shareholder point of view that it always seems so near yet so far from actually making any profit. So, I mean, how do you balance, you're more of the software company man, so how do you balance up growth and profitability, Paul, in this type of situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely want to sort of invest to accelerate the top line, to get operational, scale there, and to get improved.
Yeah.
But in this instance, it doesn't seem to be happening. The one thing I would say about PCI Pal, which has stopped me buying, is what is long term? Are you really going to need the software? And I get it, such that you can have contact centers all the time, and it can be done by chatbots, or it can be done by people, and therefore you don't want them to know your credit card details. However, having said that, you know, in the same breath, you've got the FT today, or I think it could have been yesterday, saying that the government is going to do plans that is going to make unlimited contactless payments. Okay.
I saw that.
And if you think about that, contactless payments, they don't need the 3-digit security code at all.
Yes,
they don't even need your number. They just basically use it from the chip inside. And if you ever get an industry which moves lock, stock and barrel, where it doesn't use number, it doesn't use codes anymore, 3-digit, and it doesn't even know, you know, it might not even use your card number because it doesn't need it, then assent to do their, you know, to do their fraud protection, because they're saying they're going to do fraud protection on behavior and, you know, other ways. Then that's going to put a bit of a headwind against. You could have this moment of truth that actually the 3-digit code isn't needed in 5 years' time because they'll use.
But you can't do contactless over the phone though, Paul.
At the moment. If you don't need a 3-digit number to do payments, you know, then I don't know. I'd have to think it through in total. I just find it such that I don't, you know, before I'd invest in a company that does effectively, you know, protects the 3-digit code and this sort of stuff, then is that going to be the key discriminator to stop fraud going forward? And the answer to that is the direction of travel isn't. It's an old number that actually doesn't work. I mean, I'll give you an example. Okay, my wife, right? She basically used her card. It was somewhere down in London. I think it was Transport for London. And he got hacked. Yeah. It basically got hacked by, you know, basically whoever it was. Yeah. And they used her number and used a credit card and a 3-digit number until it was flagged, you know, for, you know, improper use, etc. Yeah. And so it just shows you that actually these hackers get the numbers from all kinds of places, from the dark web. And they're not a very good control. And that's why people are moving away from them.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, the other thing to consider is different countries' culture. I mean, that was something I picked on when you and I spoke to Bango, who incidentally had a nice little announcement today about a contract win. We're talking to them again soon, aren't we?
Yes.
And they said, you know, the consumer and company behavior is so different in some geographies.
Yes.
And, you know, I can't remember the last time I paid for something over the phone. Well, actually, maybe for car insurance renewal. There have been a few things, but nearly everything I do online. But I'm not typical, say, of somebody in the Midwest in America, where I believe they're still using kind of click-clack machines in some places. You know, there some and Germany as well, amazingly, is very behind the UK in terms of. I don't know. My hunch is there's probably plenty of business to go around for PCI Pal internationally for quite some time, but look, that's a guess, isn't it? I don't really know.
Mine's a guess as well. That'd be the only thing I would say. Okay, let's move sectors again. We've got asset finance. We've got Alex Donnelly. He's asking about Distribution Finance Group that came out with some, was it results? Anyway, the shares are up a good healthy 10% today because I think their loan book is doing well. They basically provide loans to retail sort of for caravans and for
dealerships, isn't it?
Dealerships, but not your car dealerships. I think it's everything other than, you know, it's a dealership which doesn't do
bigger
cars.
Items, isn't it? Well, unfortunately, Alex has caught me on the hop a bit here because I'm halfway through writing up my section on this for today's report, and I ran out of time. So yes, now I do have to, because last time I wrote about this, I messed something up. I can't remember what it was, but I wanted to look at it again because I know I did drop a clanger and get something wrong in my last report on this. So I'm looking forward to looking at it again. Yeah, here we are. I've half written this. H1 results are out today. Specialist Bank, significant growth and momentum. This is the company headline. And full year profit to expected to materially exceed current market guidance. Now, that's very good, obviously. Personally, I don't buy into a specialist banks because I think the profit number is a matter of opinion. And then if you get some sort of really severe economic downturn, suddenly all your bad debts appear. And particularly with movable items, you know, you go in to foreclose on them and the item's gone. So, you know, I think we've discussed that before. We're talking about a different alternative lender. So I will, sorry, I can't give any more detail on this, but yeah, the market liked the H1 results up 10% roughly today. And the shares have been on a really good run actually now for a couple of years, haven't they? So, there's the chart in front of me. So it looking good, but I can't give an opinion on it yet because I haven't finished writing about it. So,
I think the net, then just on that, the net tangible assets, I think per share is about 70p. So it's still trading
below.
Yeah, about 80%, well, 20% discount to net tangible assets.
Yeah.
And
which is par for the course, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you look at STB or Close Brothers, which obviously have had all those legal shenanigans and rebounded amazingly from them. They're still at big discounts to NAV. So maybe distribution finance is possibly priced about right for now, but I'll look into it in more detail and come back to you. Probably be in tomorrow's Substack, which is free on Fridays, of course. So
Yeah, I spoke to a fund manager just before Christmas, Richard Penny of Crux Asset Management, and asked him at the end of the session what was his favourite stock for 2025. And he said this one, Distribution Finance Capital, because essentially they make very good net interest margins of about 7.5%.
That's right. I noticed that today, yeah.
And it isn't something you can just rock up and do it. This has got very little competition because you've got to basically go and, you know, visit them and size it up and look at the value of it and do it and price it accordingly. Yes, it's cyclical, but let's be clear about it. 12 months ago, the economic forecast for the UK wasn't looking good. And for him to select it as his number one, he thought this will actually outgrow even the cycle. So he was very positive and I'm sure he's very happy with it at the moment. But I think it's a better lender because there's less competition in this niche area of sort of like dealerships for things like, say, caravans and lawnmowers and all this sort of stuff.
So I'm assuming then that it's a form of bridging finance, is it? That they'll borrow against the stock of motorhomes that sit on the forecourt and pay it back piecemeal as they sell each one. Is that how it works?
It's basically like a finance lease. You know, somebody wants a caravan rather than actually, you know, buying it. Well, sorry, they'll give them the funding so they can buy it essentially. And they'll
it's not bridging funding then. It's a like a 3-year prior purchase, is it? Or something.
Well, it can be any which way you do it, I think.
But because if the dealer's actually borrowing the money, then I don't understand that. Is that what
the dealer borrows? The dealer needs money because it needs to buy it from the OEM. So if you've got basically a caravan manufacturer and it wants to put a new caravan on its stock, it doesn't got the working capital. So you give it the dealer, but it equally does for the dealer's customers as well. If the customer basically needs help, it will do for the customer.
Okay. Oh, so it's two separate things. Yeah, I need to look into it properly because I'm a bit confused.
Okay, cool. Oh, right. We've got James. One is asking about Lords Group Trading, which is the building products merchant and heating plumbing business. I think they came out with interims today. The debt had gone down. Sales were up, but I think EBITDA went down in line anyway. What was yours? Lots of puts and takes anyway. What was your overall view?
Yeah, I'm only halfway through this one as well, annoyingly. I got just one of those days today where I've just been pulled from pillar to post and I didn't manage to finish things, you know. Let me find it. It didn't madly impress me, I know that much. And the share price hasn't changed. H1 results. Yeah, like-for-like revenue up 7%, but EBITDA was down about 4%, so pretty flat. EPS was down 14%, so not great. But for the full year, it says it's expecting EBITDA in line with market expectations. Outlook, it said, quote, not seen any sustained improvement in the RMI market, unquote, which we're getting from lots, aren't we, of distributors of building products. But the way I look at it is, glass half full, maybe, on this basis, they're still in line with expectations, and that's based on there being no recovery. So maybe across the sector, maybe forecasts are now at a level where, you know, they're not factoring in any recovery, and any recovery that does emerge, you could then move into a cycle of upgrades. So I don't think Lords would be my first choice in this sector. It got tipped or ramped, whichever you want to call it, in a small caps tip sheet, I think, a while ago. And there was a lot of kind of irrational buyers, really. And it scrubbed all of that off. Oh, you can see it on the chart there.
Yeah.
So I think when these things shoot up like that on no particular, for no particular reason, chucking them out, I think it's, you know, I'm not a trader, but I do think this is a trader's market. You're getting explosive rallies in lots of shares. I think bank the profits, because you need cash to buy the dips, and sentiment can just turn on a dime. And look, there are loads of charts that look exactly like this one you put on the screen, I think. So yeah, I think keeping nimble, selling into the overdone rallies, and then buy the dips. I think that's the right strategy right now, personally.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, if you're in building products, particularly in RMI, it's a interest rate sensitive type of industry, isn't it? If interest rates start coming down in the UK, which we all hope they do, that's going to start hopefully starting to decrease in the States. And if that means that inflation is licked most places, including the UK, then interest rates will start falling here, and the whole building sector and the RMI will then become much more attractive, and people will start then doing the renovations they haven't done for the last 3 or 4 years, or moving house, and then invariably they then need new carpets, boilers, windows, doors, you name it, they need it, don't they, for their new house.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Although 2 and 5 year fixes on mortgages are now at the lowest level they've been for 2 years, which is quite surprising. And people still move house. I mean, I've followed the property market for 40, 50 years, and it's always fascinated me. And even in the depths of despair, people are still moving house. And people have had nominal terms increases of about 20% in their wages over the last 2 or 3 years. So I think once we've got the budget out of the way, that as happened last year, it's this interminable delay and speculation, isn't it, that just brings too many markets to a halt. I don't think it's affecting consumers at all. I think the average consumer, in my opinion, and all the people I talk to not in the financial sector, say that life is going on completely as normal. They're not even thinking vaguely about what's in the budget. But I think you're right when it comes to actually house moving. Maybe I'm hearing some awful stories about the London market, for example, in property. But then we're hearing from the house builders generally saying, well, actually things are ticking along all right. We have Bellway, didn't we, recently, that said that. And what about Wix? They put out a fairly good update this week. So I think, you know, I think it's not getting any worse, put it like that. And there's kind of the odd green shoot, isn't there, that maybe people are starting to do a bit more bits and bobs to their houses. Well, they're going to Wix anyway, aren't they? So
The DIY is slightly different because it's basically short turnaround, low cost type of stuff.
Yes, true. Fair point. Yeah.
And it seems as though the biggest blockage in the new build market is actually the approvals by the safety regulator to sign off buildings, because they haven't got enough people to go in there and make sure that, say, a block of flats has got all the fire safety stuff done, you know, the sprinklers and the no cladding and all that sort of stuff. And that's the big... So once they do that, then these things will unblock significantly.
Yeah, and conveyancing is still slow, I believe, because there's personnel shortages there. So it seems to me, generally, on a lot of things, I know people probably think I'm sounding too complacent, but it sounds to me like we've been through a chaotic 5-year period, and that the economy actually is kind of ticking over just about okay. I'm not saying it's good. It's clearly not good. I don't think it's getting any worse. And therefore, if you can buy things at what could be bottom of the cycle earnings on modest PEs, I think that could look quite clever in a year or two's time. But
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do you think things will get any worse in the short term, or do we have to wait till after the budget maybe before investors and companies maybe start investing more?
Yeah, I hope not. I mean, it could definitely slow things up heading into the budget. Lawrence Hulse reckoned when I interviewed him on Monday that it would do, but I actually look at it as a more glasses half full. I think the reason why the budget is so delayed is that Rachel Reeves and Starmer are going to get their MPs into line in terms of welfare benefit cuts. Well, that's my hope anyway, and because they made such a hash of it last time. And what we're going to see in the budget is basically cost cuts on the welfare budget, on the welfare system. We're probably going to get tax raises. I mean, gambling is going to get taxed. Yes. Probably banking's also going to get taxed. I would not be surprised also if they put a penny on income tax. And the reason is because to pay for defence, they'll say, you know, we've now got a war long term in Ukraine, and therefore for NATO, we need to put it up. But equally, they're going to have to cut their own cloth accordingly and reduce some of the costs and things like, I don't know. I mean, you basically higher rate pension contributions, getting all the tax benefits.
Yeah, that's a huge amount of money. I can't see that surviving.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they'll leave the main tax rates unchanged. Personally, that's my hunch. But I think you're right. I mean, the bond market. What people I know who are active in the bond market say, the bond market doesn't want to see tax rises because that'll slow the economy. They want to actually see some spending restraint.
Yes.
Yeah. And if they can demonstrate that they can actually keep a lid on all these, and it must be incredibly difficult when you've got every department demanding more money for essential spending. I don't envy them trying to balance up the books, and I'm sure it's not easy. But we are in that limbo period again, aren't we? But we know we're going to get hit one way or another. That's the way I look at it. And I don't think corporate earnings of the sort of shares I'm in, a lot of them are consumer facing as well, or cyclical turnarounds. I don't see any, I don't see any particular threat to those individual companies from the budget. I think it'll be in these niche tax raises. You know, it doesn't matter to the overall economy that investors get slapped with, or middle class affluent people or high earners get less pension tax relief, because it's an incredibly generous scheme at the moment, I think. Maybe reducing it to standard rate relief only or something. I mean, that is not going to slow the economy down, is it? So I'm glass half full.
I think the only reason why they haven't got rid of the higher rate pension contribution tax benefits before is simply because, you know, the impact on well-paid people who work for the government,
civil
servants. That's the reason why they've done it. I mean, you know, anyway, such is life. I could be just a skeptic. Okay, we've got one final question. We've got Steve. He's asking about Carlclo, the engineering stroke products business that basically came back to trade, I think. Yeah, after being suspended, the shares have done very well now. They're over 60p. Incredible turnaround here. Tip your hat to Richard Crowe, in fact, I think.
Yeah, that's right. No, absolutely. And to be fair, we turned neutral on it at the beginning of this year when the evidence of a turnaround was starting to come clear. I'll just call up my notes on Carclo. So yeah, we've been neutral on it this year, saying, look, here are the upside. It's a margin recovery story, basically.
Yeah.
And it's playing out as management said it would. So I think it's been a very good turnaround, and, you know, well done to the people who took the risk, because it was a hell of a risk, particularly last year. It came close to going bust. I don't think it's anywhere near as risky now. And they refinanced the bank debt. I think it was in April. So that was, we put in a, we've just always written about this, explaining these are the bull points and these are the bear points. And then the readers can make up their mind and decide what they want to do. Yeah. So it's very nice to see the bull case play out here. I think the last results were very good. This was on the 29th of August, but they were late. And where shares are suspended for a month, it's jolly risky to continue holding them. So people, you know, have earned their money, but they took a risk, you know.
Well, it's 10 bags. It's 10 bags since April 24. So 15 months, it's
24, 10 bags. Yeah, no, no. But like I say, in April 24, the reason it was that price was it looked about to go bust. So, you know, it's paid off. And well done to holders. And as I say, we've been neutral on it all this year, just pointing out the bull and the bear points. And then the readers make up their own mind, don't they? What their personal risk tolerance is. I nearly bought some of these. I did at one point on one of the dips, come very close, but I just couldn't push the button. So never mind. You can't go at everything. You know, I think when we got 1,200 companies in our investable universe, you can just pick the things you're most comfortable with, can't you?
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. We've got a final. We've got James. Sorry, not James. We've got Paul L. He's asking about Capita Group. He says UBS have just brought 5.5% and then increased again to 6%. I know Richard Staveley, who's probably the best performing small cap fund manager in the UK over the last 3 years, he's got a holding in this and quite likes it. They're basically an outsourcer to the UK public sector. And corporate sector used to be a darling. I think Neil Woodford owned them like 30 years ago or 20 years ago, and then has come all the way back down. They're trying to increase their margins. What was your latest view?
Well, this has always gone in our, looking back at my notes here, we were actually amber green on it 4 times earlier this year, but we moved down to amber on the 5th of August on the H1 results, because when I look at the full set of numbers again, they weren't very good. EPS in H1 was down 35%, made a statutory loss, loads of adjustments again, full year expectations unchanged. The margin improvement story isn't really happening, or not very much, not enough anyway. They say there are going to be cost savings in H2. So it's just too big and complex a business, and you've got a very weak balance sheet. It relies on customers paying up front at Capita, but it recently, I think, let go some of that low margin work, but then paid the price in terms of the upfront cash flow it was getting from those contracts. So it's just too difficult, Paul. I honestly don't know how we can assess this. Yeah. And as you can see, the same sort of share price as the other one you had up before, isn't it? Huge rally. And everyone just starts banking their profits, don't they? So too complicated for me, I'm afraid. This one's above my pay grade. So,
I would say long term, if you're going to you're going to buy the shares, you've got to be comfortable with AI, how it's actually going to benefit or hinder. It's no doubt about it going to help reduce their internal headcount because it's going to improve their productivity. However, if you're an outsourcer of services to companies, things like call centers or congestion charge and this sort of stuff, then unfortunately with AI outsourcing services, it means that a lot of that sort of manual work that you do then will get, the value add that the manual does currently will be taken out by effectively a chatbot or agentic AI and an assistant. And therefore you could see the market shrink because of, basically agentic AI coming in. So I wouldn't be running into it, even though it does look cheap and they're making it. I just think there's going to be a lot of headwinds. Plus you've obviously got the government, if we're right, and they do start reducing, their cost base, they start cutting their cloth, then, that's half their business is local government and central government as well. So I don't think it's in the best place, to be perfectly honest, to grow, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's too large and complicated. I mean, they keep finding, remember those software businesses they sold for a very good price, I think, didn't they? And you think, I didn't even know they had those, So I think it's too complicated for me. I like smaller, simple businesses that are very easy to analyze. And I'll, so not for me personally, but I wish people well with Capita.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much, Paul, for all your insights. And thanks, everyone, for your questions. If we didn't cover any, just hold them for next week. It'll be same channel, same time on Thursday. And we'll be giving you an update on our joint meeting with Eagle Line next Tuesday for their results.
Great.
So thanks again, guys.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Paul. That was great.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.